We've had several sessions in the last 2 weeks on the nuclear issue, the arms race. And on all of them, I tried to go ahead and have enough time for people to express their views on it. And I don't have a fixed agenda. I don't have notes up here. And so if you speak up, people listening on the tape, sometimes it's very hard to pick up the flavor of the group as we're going, because they don't notice the hand gestures and the noddings, yeses and nos. It's a little difficult to hear. So we'll have to speak out, but they'll have to put up with that, I guess. I want to start out with a little story and see what you can make of this story. I graduated from the Virginia Military Institute in 1961. With a degree in civil engineering. And several years before that, in the late 50s, I guess, maybe 1960 or so, I remember talking to one of our instructors who was a captain in the Air Force. He was in the Strategic Air Command, and they are the branch of the Air Force where they fly the bombers, B-52s, back then and now. Although back then they had a number of other bombers that are out of commission now. And he had been giving some lectures on the weapons that they carry. And in a moment of, I think it was a rather thoughtful moment, I could detect that on his face, he made the statement, if we ever use these devices, our mission has failed. Okay, you get the idea. If we ever use these devices, our mission has failed. That was what he was saying. Now, what do you think he meant by that? Why do you think he said that?
Well, the Strategic Air Command is a deterrent force, and only to be used in retaliation. And so, if, theory being, if they're strong enough to prevent the enemy, whoever that might be, from attacking, then they have succeed in their mission. If we are attacked, then supposedly they have failed.
Okay, so the idea then, let me paraphrase, is that the Strategic Air Command is there to prevent war rather than to fight a war. That's pretty much what you're saying. Okay, anybody else want to add on that? Now remember, what he said is if we ever use these, our mission has failed. Okay, that was his expression. Anybody else have some insights into how why he might say that? Yes.
Well, that's one of the missions of SAC, is deterrence. But they also have to maintain an offensive capability that in the event war does start, that they're prepared to fly the bombers and drop them.
Well, why do they have to do that?
Well, they're one arm of the triad.
Why would they have to? I mean, basically, my understanding of why they do that is to maintain a credible threat. Okay? In other words, I don't think that we have a policy of if the Soviet Union's air defenses are down, we will attack. I don't think that's been part of the policy of the American government. So it's been mainly in terms of strategic, in other words, they're not planning to start a war, let's put it that way.
They're prepared to fight a war, however.
Yes. Well, let's go ahead and let's take a look at that, and that might be one. But nevertheless, when he said our mission has failed, our primary mission, if we ever use the weapons, he was speaking, I think, in the sense that their primary mission is to deter a war. Okay. Yeah. Primary mission is to deter a war. Okay, so let's go ahead and take a look at the notion of deterrence. How would they prevent a war? How do you think that they prevent a war by having the weapons? Or how do you think they prevent a war? What is the argument behind that? And I don't mean this judgmentally. You can be either for or against. I'm just trying to ask for your interpretation of why he might have said that.
Well, presumably by maintaining a credible military power that if in the event it had to be used, it could be used successfully against the enemy.
To use a rather simple example, it's like children on a playground with a bunch of snowballs. If you've got a snowball in your hand and the guy across the street has got four, you're going to be less likely to throw it at him.
Okay. That's a little different than what you said. And what you said is a little different than what Ronald Reagan said, I think, in the sense that I think Ronald Reagan did say anybody who thinks they can win a war like this is crazy. I think that, you know, that they were saying that. Am I correct in that? Didn't he say that? All right, so in terms of successful, we have to watch out how we use the war. And that's why he was saying, this officer was saying, if we use these weapons, we have failed. Okay, that's, in other words, the primary mission, I think, is what you're saying, is you maintain a threat so someone will not start the war. Okay, does that fit? Okay, well, now let's pursue it. I don't want to, we'll have the different discussions of why, how you might do this. But I think the idea of deterrence is the primary mission of Strategic Air Command was deterrence in that you prevent a war from happening, and that's why this officer said, if we use these weapons, our mission has failed. And the idea being what you're saying over there is you maintain some sort of a threat so that someone else who might decide to attack you says, no, I won't, because it's too dangerous for me to do that. Okay, is that the fit of your perceptions? Okay, well, let me see if I can paraphrase this. It seems to me, then, that what use do we have of the weapons other than fighting them? I mean, you know, the primary use of the weapons is not to actually fight, but to deter. And it seems to me that what the theory has to do, and I'm not trying to judge this one way or another, so I'm trying to be careful on this. What the theory tries to do is to create a perception in the minds of the Soviet leaders, primarily the Soviet leaders, that the use of nuclear weapons is simply irrational, unreasonable, crazy. Because if they were to use those weapons, then there would be tremendous destruction on them. That's the basic idea. So deterrence has to deal with perceptions. Okay, we agree with that? It has to deal with perceptions. If the Soviet Union, if we had all of these weapons and they were secret, and they didn't know that we had them, then of course deterrence wouldn't work. Okay, deterrence wouldn't work. So let's be clear that deterrence is dealing with perceptions. Okay, now I'm going to borrow a little, a term that theologians use, and that quite often, and that is the word context. That is, when you have a perception, it's within a given context, or you make a decision, it's within a given context, a certain historical situation, a certain situation, and that influences how you see things and how you make your decisions. We had a theologian explained that if you wanted to understand what the scripture was saying, you had to know whether the context was before the Babylonian captivity or after. Okay, and if you didn't know that, okay, then you didn't know how to interpret what they were saying. So what we're doing in, or claiming in, the strategic deterrence is to shut that down. What we're doing in the strategic deterrence is trying to sustain a context within which the Soviets would perceive that the use of nuclear weapons is irrational. Okay, is that correct? So let's just go ahead and say we want to get a context, and I'm going to write this on the board, so those listening on the tapes, unfortunately, they can't see the board. We're trying to say a context in which the use of nuclear weapons, is one irrational. Or we might say useless. Wait a minute. Every time I look down at useless, let me just go ahead. Irrational. When you're looking down there, it's awfully hard. Let's just start out with one, because I want to get a few other things up. All right, so we maintain a context where the use of nuclear weapons is irrational, okay? And by irrational, what they usually mean is if the Soviet Union were to go ahead and do a benefit-cost analysis They'd figure the benefits, and they'd figure the cost. The cost would be so high that they'd far exceed any possible benefits, even if they made a mistake in the calculations, and therefore it would be irrational to launch a nuclear attack. That's the idea. That's kind of what you were saying with the snowball fighters, right? Okay. Yes?
Do you think there's a consensus in the United States on what the Soviet Union's nuclear policy is, A, and B, do you think that most Americans would perceive their policy to be deterrence also?
I would say, number one, no, there is not a consensus in the United States on what the Soviet Union would be. In fact, there's some rather extreme debates. And also, the Soviet Union is not a static system. You have to remember that they formed many of their ideas at a time when we had nuclear weapons and they didn't. So now that's not the case. They've got enormous nuclear weapons, so there's kind of a transition in their own thought. So there's some debate on that. I do think that in terms of the justification for the American nuclear weapons, that the concept of this deterrence has been the central to our own perception about why we have these weapons. I think it has been central. It is right now being a very, very debatable concept right now. In fact, there's tremendous debates on it, and many people are rejecting it on moral grounds. So we're at a crisis right now. The United States of America, in terms of its concepts, is at a crisis. That the credibility of deterrence in many people's minds, it has been undermined. That means they no longer believe it. And you can go to the bookstore and read a whole lot of books on that.
That's only a post-war policy, too, because clearly in World War II, clearly it wasn't a deterrence policy at all.
No, deterrence,
a knockout.
Right. Deterrence was conceived, deterrence came to the forefront as we developed nuclear weapons. They began to say, what use of these can you make of these? And they were so destructive that the idea that you can kind of use them in kind of the way you might a rifle or a can or a tank, it just wasn't perceived. Now, it took some time for the concept of deterrence to set in, but it was recognized by a number of people, particularly Bernard Brody, who wrote some of the early work on this, as soon as the bomb went off. He was writing a book, I believe, on naval power, military power. And when he heard about the bomb, he just took the draft of his book and threw it out and says, the whole new game. And deterrence is what came out, preventing war. Okay. That has been the center of the United States policy, and it is now being challenged by many people. And this is one of the reasons why there is so much turmoil in the United States over whether we should have nuclear weapons, which ones we should have, how we should think about them, what we should do with them, what should be our strategic doctrine. It's in a state of turmoil. It is. Yes.
Could add a comment, perhaps. I think it's important to understand what it is we're deterring, too. Because in one sense, perhaps the nuclear weapons are deterring the use of nuclear weapons on the other side, but they are certainly not deterring aggressive acts.
Okay. Well, I want to get at the concept of the nuclear deterrence, because there's a whole, you can actually spread on what you're trying to deter, but let's just stick for the time being on the deterrence of them using the nuclear weapons. Let's just stick on that. And then later, what we can do is we can show how the discussion expands. All right, we agree then that what we're trying to do is sustain a context within which the use of nuclear weapons appears to be irrational. Because the purpose of it is to prevent the use of nuclear weapons. Okay, that's the primary purpose of deterrence, is to prevent the use of nuclear weapons. And the theory says this: if an enemy who is thinking about using nuclear weapons perceives it to be irrational, there will be a lower probability that they'll use them. That's the idea. Okay, now what I want you to do is, this is the classic theory, and what I'd like to have is people who might not agree with this, to see if we can expand that. What else might prevent, what other concepts might prevent a person from using nuclear weapons? This is rationality. What else? Why might a person not use? Why wouldn't you use a nuclear weapon?
Moral.
All right, so that there's another dimension here, if we're going to accept the idea that we can have a context where the use of nuclear weapons is irrational, I think we would also like to have, I would, a context in which the use of nuclear weapons is also immoral. Okay? Now you agree with that? Okay? So what we're saying is, if we can sustain, let's be idealists now, and let's not think too much about the traditional notion of deterrence, but let's just us expand the idea of context and decision. If we can go ahead and create a context within which the use of nuclear weapons is irrational and immoral and impractical and useless, and what are some other words we could use?
Uneconomic,
well, okay, that kind of fits under irrational, I think. Economics, in fact, very interesting you point that out, because the theory of nuclear deterrence came out of largely economists. And this is why, if you pick up their literature, the idea of the moral dimension is almost never mentioned. You know, and if you pick up a text on economics, you'll find the rational man, they will say. They use sexist language also. And you'll find that they think of all consumers doing these benefit-cost analysis and doing all these things. And of course, a lot of sociologists look at that and read it and laugh and say, wait a minute, there's a lot more. But what we're saying then is that if we can create a context within which the use of nuclear weapons is considered irrational, immoral, impractical, useless, what are some other words?
Unsurvivable,
ridiculous,
suicidal,
self-destructive, morally wrong, horrible, murderous. Sinful. Okay, we'll put sinful down. Let's, okay.
When did it become irrational? Was it always irrational?
Well, I guess that depends who you are. What we're trying to do is we're trying to sustain a context so that anyone who really thinks about it would conclude at least one of these, and that would prevent them from using it.
Okay? I imagine that there was some influence to that when several countries developed
right.
the bomb. So
that's
then it became totally irrational.
Well, hopefully, that's what we're hoping, that it will become totally irrational and considered to be totally immoral, totally sinful, and then what happens every time we create this context, the theory says, the probability of it being used becomes less and less. Okay? I mean, they might make a mistake, you know, they might misplace several digits in their benefit-cost analysis and say, it's rational, push the button. Well, you know, we hope they won't do that. Yes?
I would think that you move from rationality to whether the use of nuclear weapons was moral or immoral, if you decide to determine that it's immoral to use it, then I would argue that all weapon systems, I mean, you just can't isolate nuclear weapons and say, well, these are immoral, but chemical weapons or conventional weapons are moral to use.
Well, I'm not claiming that they're moral or rational or sinless.
No, it may be. Okay. No, it may be irrational.
I'm not claiming that.
The use of nuclear weapons may be irrational if, in fact, when doing your calculations, no one's going to survive it. So you can argue that on a rationality standpoint. It seems to me the morality question is one that extends far beyond nuclear weapons.
Oh, I would say the rationality one does too, and the sinful one does too. Right now, you're right. I mean, I'm not, by just focusing on nuclear weapons, I'm not claiming that other weapons are somehow rational or moral or anything else. I'm saying let's stick to the nuclear question right now. We can later go ahead and see how it goes out. Okay? I want to stick to the idea of nuclear deterrence right now. And the idea, what I'm saying is, if our purpose is to prevent the use of nuclear weapons by some group of individuals, then what we want to do is sustain a context where it's irrational, immoral, sinful, useless, and all those other words. We want to sustain a context within which people make decisions. So if they don't make it on a rational basis, maybe they'll make it on a moral basis. If they don't make it on that, they'll make it on a sin basis. If they don't make it on that, they'll make it on what will history think of me basis. Okay? In other words, we want to sustain a context where it becomes more and more difficult for anyone, for any reason, to come up with, boy, let's use them. Okay? That's what we would like to do. Yes?
Well, you see, the thing is, I don't think I buy into the system you're describing. For the simple reason that deterrent, see, we've built a rational base for as a deterrent based on a larger context. The larger context, and I presented the argument badly yesterday, so I worked a bit on it. You see, the larger context, in my mind, is ideological. The arguments at the technological level are idiotic.
What we're doing is we're trying to make a context for anybody who has any ideology.
They can't right. come into
so
it.
So you're basically saying we ought to get rid of the weapons?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's. I think
you're going into a
all right.
to a
I don't
to
know.
A path that you can't come out of.
Well,
you
well,
can't. How are you going to
wait? Wait.
This is where we are.
Let's just go. I think. Okay. Let's stick with it. Let's stick with it. We'll come back to the ideological. Because are you saying that ideological arguments override rationality, morality, and sinfulness, and survivability?
No. I guess I want to say to it that the argument of any type of nuclear war, nuclear weaponry, any weaponry is irrational. It is very likely. It's likely immoral. It's unethical.
I'll agree with you.
It is full of sin.
I'll agree.
Now, we can talk about a side, you see, but and I'm willing to go along with it. But when we're dealing with a suicidal, idiotic technology that relates to it, how are we going to move into that without dealing with the side that we're dealing with it?
What you're saying is that you feel like the discussion of deterrence is irrelevant in terms of what we need to discuss as ideology? Okay, well, let's get at that later. Let's stick right now to the concept of deterrence, and then later, if we want to do that, we can. What I want to do is I want to get... This, by the way, is not... What we've developed here is not the traditional notion of deterrence. I want to point that out. The traditional notion of deterrence generally stops right here. And I've read the literature in it, and the idea of enhancing moral deterrence, that is, enhancing the context in which a person, regardless of where they are, perceives this as more and more immoral, generally has not been part of traditional deterrence. What's been the part of traditional deterrence has basically this part of it, okay, where they say we will go ahead and we will develop lots of weapons, and therefore we will create a context within which the use of nuclear weapons is truly, no matter how they calculate it, perceived to be irrational. Okay, now that's the argument that's happened. And if I read the literature on deterrence, I find very little on the morality of it, and very certain nothing on the sinfulness of it. Okay, I find that. So what I'm saying is, what we did is what this is not to the notion of deterrence. We took the general concept of deterrence. We want to create a context within which people will decide not to use weapons. And then we said, if we can create a context where it's irrational, immoral, sinful, useless, and all of those other things, that would be a good thing to do. Okay, that would be a good thing to do. Let me get over here, and then here.
The observation I have is the context skewered completely by the fact that the United States is the only nation that has used nuclear weapons.
No, I think right now, I don't think that the context is... The Soviets might make a political argument on that. Of course, we would never use them. And therefore, all we have to deter against is the United States. But I don't think anybody who studied the history, if the Soviet Union had been involved in World War II and had nuclear weapons, they probably would have used them. So I think there's a political kind of propaganda kind of argument on that. But between the United States and the Soviet Union, I don't think I mean, I'm not minimizing the importance of that decision to use them. But I think right now, if we decided not to use nuclear weapons in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, you could still have this concept of deterrence still emerging. Yeah, right here.
It seems like a two-edged sword in a way that, in the sense that if we want some other country to believe us that on the one hand that we will use the weapons given the right set of circumstances in order to further deter them from trying to pull anything on us, so then we have a philosophy or theory of mutually assured destruction that we announce, that we further intensify the whole level of threats and counter threats.
Okay, so there's some problems in this.
It's an attempt to try to make them believe that we'll use it so that we can deter them from
Okay, now here we're getting on to this. Let's just, you're getting on to the next level of the discussion, and I'd like to pursue. So far in the discussion, which you've kind of got, you're kind of seeing where I'm going, we're saying if we could maintain a context within which the use of nuclear weapons is perceived by anyone to be irrational, immoral, sinful, useless, and all of those things, that's not a bad idea. However, what you're saying is, wait a minute, by doing that in particular ways, we may actually undermine it. Let me see if I can paraphrase, and I'll get to you. Let's suppose we decide that one way of doing that is having as many possible weapons as possible. Okay? The rationale being that any enemy who decided to do a benefit-cost analysis on this would go ahead and they would find the costs are so high that the benefits could never exceed the cost, and therefore they decide not to strike. However, you're saying, wait a minute, there's another dimension to that. Let's think about that. Suppose that enemy sees all of your weapons out there, and in a state of crisis, that enemy concludes, they're going to hit us. Why else do they have all those weapons? Now, the decision for the enemy becomes different. The enemy starts saying, in a state of panic, the enemy starts saying, aha, the only choice I have is whether I go first or second. You get the idea? They become convinced that you are going to attack them. Okay? Now, it doesn't matter, you see, if we say, oh no, we would never do that. That's not the point, right? The point is, what would they believe, and not what would they believe today when everything's nice and calm, but in a state of internal panic among themselves, what might they believe in a state of a crisis such as the Cuban Missile Crisis? What might they come to believe? So there is kind of a double bind in here. There's kind of a paradox thrown in here that you've pointed out, that if we maximize the threat in order to make it seem irrational, we may go to the point that here's what happens. They think we are going to attack them. And then they say, aha, the only choice is, do I go first or second? And then what's the rational thing to do?
Go first.
See how the thing gets switched around? So there's a danger in that. Plus that, and I'll get to you in a minute, if we go ahead and we have a tremendous number of weapons and we threaten them in order to sound credible, we begin to undermine the immorality of the use of that. They begin to say, well, gee, if they can use them, and they're convincing us that they would use them, then of course we can use them. See? So what may happen is, by focusing on this threat too much, we may undermine rationality and the moral, as well as the sinful, objections to the use of nuclear weapons. There's a danger in that. And it's that balance that we have to struggle with. What would happen, let's just go ahead and pursue our exploration of context. Because what I'm doing is, if we try to create this context one way, we may undermine it another way. And what we're trying to do is get a context where this thing seems irrational, immoral, and sinful. Okay, right here and then back to here. Yes?
Okay, I just have a question regarding the context. Isn't it true that in history, nations or nation states have the bottom line has been self-preservation, self-enhancement, and has never been what is morally right or what is not sinful. So aren't we, just to create an image
I don't think so. Also, the use of nuclear, the study of how wars begin is very complex. And quite often wars begin because another side feels threatened. They feel like their opportunity to exert any kind of control, such as the Japanese, is slipping away, so it's now or never. So there are a lot of different reasons. I think it's right. We ought to examine that. However, in the use of nuclear weapons, where it's like that, the start, the moral dimension does appear to come in. We know President Kennedy, for example, was really overwhelmed with that. He didn't want to be known as the American Tojo that is attacking, launching an air attack, and that was even a conventional attack. We do know in communist ideology, they claim history is on our side. Well, maybe history will judge them poorly. I'm sure they have concerns like that. There's an awareness of the tremendous destructiveness of these things, and I can't help but believe, that if we have human beings up in there, that's certainly one of the considerations. And if the moral consideration is weak among the leadership, then it seems like the citizens better strengthen it. Because I do think moral constraints, certainly if you talk to our own military people, for example, there's a deep moral concern there, a very deep one. Now, unfortunately, in our technological culture, we tend to focus on the rational a little bit more than the moral. I do think that the moral dimensions are very real. Let me get over here, here, and there. Okay, here.
As far as the Russian ideology that there is no God, doesn't that affect whether or not they even exist anymore? Obligation beliefs?
I think I would really be careful of confusing ideology with beliefs. I would say that there are probably more dedicated Christians in the Soviet Union than probably dedicated communists.
Leaders?
No, just a second. I mean, plus that, I'm not sure how much they believe their own ideology. I think it has a system of large forms of control. I'm not really sure how they believe that. Plus that, their ideology is not amoral. Even if you take it as amoral, they really believe that history is on their side and the right is there. And plus that, I think morality comes out not so much out of the ideology that we preach, so much as the relationships that we have. Now, I'm worried. Obviously, you get a person within a totalitarian state, they can be a very isolated group up there. So it seems to me that the argument, well, let's make clear to them that this is an immoral act, is important. See, almost every government, particularly a totalitarian government, depends upon credibility. They worry about the credibility of their own government. And so they are constantly making moral claims for their credibility. They're constantly making moral claims. So they are deeply concerned about their moral credibility. And if you look at the civil defense program in the Soviet Union, from what I've heard, they're worried about losing control if there was a nuclear war. They're worried about that. And so I think they are sensitive, if for no other reason than they want to keep power, there may be more reasons, to at least looking like you're moral. I mean, Machiavelli would want to look like they're moral, okay? Now, I'm not accusing them of being immoral, though. I don't know them, okay? Let's see, right here?
I was going to make the point that this lady brought up here, but I'm still not sure about how operative this model is, given that ideology and wanting to make some suppositions, but in the absence of any empirical evidence about what the Russian people believe or not, that's what it is, a simple supposition. The other thing I would argue is that there is a construct that has set the relationship between the United States and the Soviet Union, this whole area, and that's the balance of power that has been in there as an operative construct between the United States and at least since the post-war period of the United States, in terms of what one move is predicated on a move by someone else. And both the Russian leaders and American leaders, and there's a lot of literature on this, talk about this.
But we're still escaping from the concept of deterrence, because the concept of deterrence still is to prevent the use, nuclear deterrence, the use of the weapons. Now, there's a whole lot else going on.
Well, that's what
there's a whole lot else going on.
Power, though. I mean, it really is. Most of that is predicated on where they stand vis-a-vis the other in the whole nuclear area in terms of nuclear
power. I really doubt that. I think that the idea of nuclear deterrence is not that, boy, I've got 5% more warheads than they have, so therefore I might be able to use them. I don't think that that kind of thinking, you know, goes on. I think the idea is, regardless of how many they have or I have, this is the classical theory, it's just, however you count them, it's irrational to use them. The costs are so much greater than the benefits. That's the traditional notion of deterrence. The idea that they do, you know, they count up all these little numbers and stuff, I think from everyone I've talked to, gets, you know, is overrated. Obviously, it becomes politically important to not look like you're behind. But in terms of whether you would actually use them or not, it seems to me the context of irrationality and immorality, maybe sinfulness doesn't belong there, maybe we need some other words, it seems to me that is a reality. No, I won't use them because it's irrational, crazy to use them, it's wrong to use them, it's useless to use them, when it finally gets down to the decision to use them. Now, there's a whole lot else going on in power politics. Yes?
I've got a question in terms of if you wish to limit the context just to the U.S. and to the Soviet Union, because...
Right now, yes.
Okay.
Right now, I would. One of the reasons we get into a whole other dimension, the Soviet Union and the United States are pretty much in agreement over non-proliferation.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. There's another problem that in terms of the third world country, say, using, say, a Gaddafi and so forth, the real big problem is to make sure that their use of an atomic bomb doesn't set off our whole systems of many more hydrogen bombs. Okay, so I would like to stick to the concept of deterrence, okay? And we can go on after. Yes?
There's one other word that we haven't used yet in regard to the use of nuclear weapons, and that is unnecessary.
Okay, unnecessary. That would be another one. Some people might say
it's very awkward.
Let's take unnecessary, useless, irrational, immoral. I won't write them all up on there, but all of those things that would, those words that would say it doesn't make sense, either moral, rational, utilitarian sense to use them. We want to preserve a context. The idea of deterrence, you know, our expanded notion of deterrence is to preserve a context where people come to that conclusion. Right here, and then I'll get back. So I want.
Would you define immoral as a sense of right and wrong?
Well, I would say immoral is when a person said this is wrong. They believe it's wrong. They feel it's wrong. I don't think they define it in terms of rules and principles. They may use those, but I think that again, that comes out of a context of how they've talked about it. That's what other people feel. It's not something that's just kind of implanted in your brain. And what? Okay.
I would say that has almost no relationship. I wouldn't say almost no, but the Soviet Union would have very much a sense of what is right and wrong, or an idea of what should be done and what should not be done, even if it is agnostic or atheist.
Yeah, I think there's a morality there. I would say that the concept of deterrence, if you look at the basic concept of deterrence, the arguments are not based upon this is exactly the way the Soviet Union behaves. You could take the concept of deterrence and assume that there was a whole new nation that emerged that we don't even know about, and the concept of deterrence, nuclear, and they had nuclear weapons, the concept of deterrence as it is now stated in the United States and as the critics have also stated would still apply. Okay, now, one more quick one. Right. If it's on the concept of deterrence, I don't want to let it get out of hand. Okay.
My only point in bringing up the unnecessary portion of it is that if you think about it, it may be unnecessary to use them, but it may be necessary to have them.
Okay, that's one of the arguments. That's there. That's one of the arguments there is that it may be immoral to actually use them, but don't tell them that. We know that we're going to have them, or let's put it this way. Here's another way that people argue. Okay? If we, well, let me go on. We'll get into, because you two in particular have raised some of the issues that are coming up today in the debate. Let me give you, let's just talk about irrational and immoral. I use those two words, and we will encompass usefulness, necessity, and all those other kinds of things in that. Right? I don't want to keep reciting all these words. We want to create as many reasons, a context, for as many reasons not to use the weapons as possible. Okay, that's what we'd like to do. Now, let me explain to you some of the debates that are now occurring. Okay, some of the debates and some of the criticisms of those debates. There are some people who are arguing, in order to make it truly irrational for them to use that, you have to demonstrate to them your willingness to use it. Okay? And the more extreme ones say, Colin Gray, for example, in order to demonstrate that you would actually go ahead and use it, you have to develop a war-winning strategy. Not only do you have to convince them that you'll use it, but you have to get them to believe that if you used it, you would win in some meaningful way. That's one of the arguments. The people are criticizing that argument. They're saying, and I just gave you one of the criticisms, if they think you're going to use it, if they truly believe that you're going to use it, then it may make sense for them to use it first. Plus that, if you're going around demonstrating that you're willing to use it, aren't you undermining the moral dimensions against the use? Aren't you undermining the moral dimension of deterrence? Now, in the literature, you don't find much at all about the moral dimension of deterrence. Okay? In the literature, you find very little. And yet, I personally believe it's a major, major reason why we haven't used these weapons is because people, you know, both in the Soviet Union and the United States, just feel it would be a horrible wrong. And certainly if you talk to the American military, you pick that up. Now, I haven't spoken to enough of the Soviets, or any of them for that matter, but I can't believe that they are such an entirely different species that they would come up with, you know, with an opposite conclusion. So if we take the war-winning strategy, I think right now it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. However, what they make, and I've heard some pacifists make this argument, not for weapons, but they say if one of the reasons they criticize deterrence is you've got, in order for it to work, you have to convince them that you would use it. And I'm not willing to convince them that I use it because it's immoral, therefore I don't want to have nuclear weapons. That's their argument. They're mixing up the idea of context. I think both of them are losing the idea of context. What we can say right now in the context of today is, all right, it is immoral and irrational to use nuclear weapons. We would not do that. That's the context of today. If the Soviet Union were to launch a nuclear attack against us, would that be the same context? You know, what would happen? I don't know. Okay? The Soviet Union would have to bear the responsibility of destroying that context. So I think it's very, very important for us in the context of today to demonstrate the immorality of using the weapons and to tell them we believe it's irrational and immoral to use those weapons. That's the context that's here. And then the Soviet Union starts thinking and they say, well, if I were to launch an attack, it would be a whole new context, you see? And they might not think that way anymore. Okay, I'm just assuming we've got this people who are seriously considering. Plus that, by us maintaining a context where it is irrational and immoral, where we convey to them that we believe that it's irrational and immoral, they are less likely to turn around and say, they're about to attack us. Okay? They're less likely to say that. And therefore, they're less likely to rationally conclude it's better to go first than second. Okay? You see what I mean? Now, one of the weak points of deterrence right now, and I think we need to struggle with, is the moral dimension. The moral dimension. Okay? Now, one way to avoid this discussion is to just assume that, say, all the people in the military are immoral and therefore we won't talk with them. That's not, you know, that's not the case. If you've ever met the people there and talked with them, they have moral concerns on this. John Howard Yoder is a pacifist, and he talks about the just war theory, and I think he is making the argument that just if you have a just war theory, if you believe that the use of weapons is evil, but it may not be the ultimate evil. It may be in some conditions the lesser of those evils. He's not saying you and I are totally different. He's not saying that. He's a pacifist. He does believe that violence is the ultimate evil. But what he's saying is we are part of a community. We agree that it is immoral. So even if you have the just war theory, even if you believe that there are some conditions where violence is needed, he's saying, all right then, let's work together to demonstrate together, you know, our moral concerns and to put it into practice, because he's claiming just war theory is not really put to practice. And as I read the literature, it does appear to me that the whole question of moral deterrence, you know, is almost irrelevant in the literature. Okay? Now, I've kind of attacked the war-winning people. So let me just tell you what they would say about the pacifist. Okay, what they would say. Okay? They would say the pacifist would unilaterally remove our weapons, and that if they said that, that's the way they say it. Now whether the pacifists actually say that or not, this is what the critics of the pacifists say the pacifists are saying. Okay? Then they would say, wait a minute, if we had unilateral disarmament, then you would create a context where even though it might be immoral to use them, it might appear rational and useful to use them because there would be no price to pay. Okay? So that the immoral leader who previously was deterred because of rational considerations would no longer be deterred from rational considerations. So that's the criticism that the war fighters would make on the pacifist. So you see, one of them tends to stress this, and one tends to stress this.
Okay? But even under that context, this context we got here with that theory, you could say that if the other side is neither rational or moral at that time, this context
that's right. That's right. If it's neither rational nor moral or practical, then there may be nothing we can do about it. That's the breakdown. Now, the real concern, and I'll get to this, this is the breakdown of the whole theory, is what you're saying. Where some people are arguing is the breakdown of this theory could occur, is that as you develop large organizational systems connected with large computer systems that have to make a decision like that in a time of crisis, that a war just may unravel and no one makes a decision. Everyone agrees that it's immoral and irrational, but it happens anyhow. Okay? Now we've got to deal with that. See, the traditional deterrence doesn't deal with that. Traditional deterrence assumes there are really people making decisions. If you look at the outbreak of World War I, you find out it just kind of unraveled. And if you read Barbara Tuchman's book, The Guns of August, fascinating book, she describes, and I don't find many male historians who tell you these little things. Okay? She describes the leaders, I don't know how she got the information, bursting into tears and crying as the war broke out. That's not our macho image. They seem to be caught up in a system, they know it's irrational and immoral and they can't stop. That's something deterrence theory as we now practice it does not deal with. And it's something that we have to struggle with. Okay? Well, something we have to struggle with, and I think it's going to really take some prodding from the outsiders to do this, because you know it's hard. Anyhow, I think one of the things we know about the history before World War I is that the civilians were not supposed to raise any issues that dealt with the military policy, and the military was the one that was to do it. And that was the prehistory of World War I, and we ended up with a war that unraveled. And we've got to deal with that, okay? But I'd like to stick, okay, so you've already got a limitation on deterrence. Okay, so we've got two things here that we can agree on. We need to sustain a context where it is irrational and immoral to use nuclear weapons, and then we have to also prevent a situation where the war just unravels. These are the kinds of things that we're trying to do. Okay, now, what we need now, I think, is for a community such as ourselves, where, you know, we're kind of the outsiders, we're not part of the tradition as a community. Some of us, of course, when we go back into our jobs, are part of the insiders. In fact, all of us to some degree are. I mean, I teach engineering, and, you know, what, 30% of them go into some military kind of affairs. So, you know, I'm, in a sense, I'm part of the inside too. So I'm not pointing fingers at the insiders and outsiders. It seems to me that right now, the way the situation is, that how could we express more the immorality of the use of nuclear weapons? Okay? And I think what Yoder is, one of the things Yoder is trying to say is, let's not argue whether you have to be a pacifist or a just war theorist. Let's get on with the work. Let's not waste our time arguing among each other. Let's make this a more peaceful world. Let's work for it. And one of the ways we might do this, and I say only one of the ways in terms of deterrence, is how do we strengthen the concept of moral deterrence? How do we do this? I think part of it involves debate over the selection of the actual weapon systems we have. If they appear, from the Soviets' viewpoint, to look like aggressive weapons, then we're probably undermining the moral deterrence, okay, if they appear. This has been the criticism of the MX missile, because some people claim, from the Soviets' perspective, it looks like an offensive missile, and if we are displaying offensive missiles, then are we undermining the whole moral objections to the use of nuclear war? That's one of the objections. Yes?
Two things. One is, how are we to know what the Soviets will view as being moral and immoral? Because obviously it's to their advantage to say everything we produce is immoral.
That's right.
If we follow that
That's
argument.
Right. So we just have to make it more difficult for them to make that. You're right. And the same thing is true the other way around.
Sure.
Right.
And the other thing was, if you're not having an aggressive missile, what is it going to do? I mean, what is a missile but an aggressive...
Well, let me give you an example, just to throw out an example. Just to think about, okay, because we don't have time to debate the whole thing. When the Scowcroft Commission went and examined the MX missile, okay, they recommended 100 MXs instead of 200. Okay, and they also recommended a Midget Man missile. No, we don't talk more about that. And they said, this will appear to be a less aggressive missile. And the reason why is the MX has 10 warheads on it. 10 warheads on it. So that means if we were to target, of course we say, oh, we're not going to go ahead and launch an attack against the Soviets. That's not the point. The point is, how might they think about it, right? That's what you're raising, okay? Let's suppose, and they go ahead and they take some rational perspective, and they look at it, and then they say, well, see, if they fire two of their warheads against each one of our missiles, they fire one missile, 10 warheads. Each one, we put two of our warheads on each one of their missiles. We get a 5-to-1 trade-off, right?
Well,
we're
playing with numbers.
I know, but we're saying, in deterrence, we're saying, suppose they start thinking that way, okay? Now, the Midget Man has one. So, let's assume that the Soviets are actually trying to calculate what we're trying to do. They say, gee, if they only putting one on there, they obviously can't be trying to attack us, because if they fire two of their warheads at one of our missiles, they're going to be, they're going to trade the wrong way. They're going to lose two for every one, rather than gaining 5-to-1. So the argument being that the Midget Man missile is less threatening than the MX. Now, people from the pacifist tradition don't like to talk about the lesser of two evils. Say it's all evil, and they don't like to discuss it. Okay? And I think Yoder is, in a sense, even though this book is a challenge on the just war people, he's also challenging, I think, the pacifist. It's a very interesting book. He's saying, let's practice what we preach, let's do the best we can. So the Midget Man, from that perspective, might, in the eyes of the Soviets, look less threatening. I went one step further, and I've got a paper on this, and I said, let's not even put the warheads, any warheads, on the Midget Man. Let's deploy them separately so they can't be fired as a weapon. Okay? They can't be fired as a weapon. Okay? Now, don't laugh at it. You got to think, it's different. So you begin to say, Gee, it sounds crazy. We ought to build at least a 24-hour time delay in the system so that the system doesn't run away. That's one of the things I'm saying. You still would have traditional deterrence in the sense that it would be irrational for them to fire, you know, one of their good missiles against one of our armor missiles, and they'd be mobile missiles. The chances of them getting them are very slim. Okay, very slim. Much slimmer than the ones with the MX missile right now. And they'd always be faced the threat, even though we claim that it's immoral, that if they were to launch an attack, we just might put those warheads back on those missiles and fire them back at them. Okay? So there are some things we could do. Now, there's another way we might deploy our technology to go ahead and strengthen this dimension. Okay, it's a bell ring. Let me just introduce one other idea. Okay, one other idea is I think what we ought to do is we ought to have a satellite archival system that maintains for history the record of how any war would start. A satellite archival system. In other words, use our and have it under the United Nations or some other group. Use our technology to demonstrate, to create a context that reinforces the immorality. And we could put the headquarters in Nuremberg, okay? And in other words, use the technology to create the perception that the use of these weapons is immoral, okay? And we could do that without, even if we didn't change any of our other systems, I think we could do that, okay? Obviously there's some of our other systems I'd like to change. In other words, we would take technology, devices. That's the way we communicate. Remember we said we communicate by trying to change the perception in the Soviets by deploying certain devices. Why not deploy a satellite archival system that says, hey, that maintains the record for history?
There is history.
Okay, if there is history. But that raises the question. You see, what it does is you act out in the deployment of your technology, a moral statement. The moral statement being, we all have a responsibility to history. Now, you know, if there is no history, well, you know, that may be. But it's still important to act out the moral statement in the devices that we deploy. Okay? Now, stick to this one. I don't want to jump around too much because we're getting near the end. We can talk
about it. One of the things that, you know, I don't think we can get far afield from where we are.
Well, I think we can.
And where we are is the marketplace for weapons acquisitions. It's the Congress of the United States.
Right.
So you want to talk about how
Wait. Well, we're getting off the top.
Well, no, it's not off the top, it's right on.
You're right.
They decide what weapons we buy and
but
they vote for them.
When they decide, they use the concept of deterrence for their arguments. And you can see that. They use the concept. And what I'm saying is, I think what we ought to do is we ought to expand the concept of deterrence. We ought to include the idea of the moral dimension as part of the deterrence, okay, in order to make a safer system. And I think we can make sound arguments for that.